May. The date is August 19th, 1975. What I'm going to do is to summarize three interviews that I had at Loon Lake, Michigan with Elmer Makela, M-A-K-E-L-A. Elmer is the one person who probably knows more about the history of the Finn camp itself and has been actively involved in the Finn camp over the years and still lives out at Loon Lake and is now, 90 years old. Elmer did not wish to have his interviews taped, not at Wayne State. He didn't want to have the tape recorder used at the lake. I had three interviews with him. The first was in mid-July, at the time that the project I had in mind was only in its beginning stages. He had heard of it from the Felts, and he brought me a statement which is included in the records. It was in Finnish, and it described Detroit workers' history. But since I couldn't understand Finnish, he took the statement home with him with promising to get it translated for me. However, he did not then return it. At that time, that conversation was approximately 1 hour, and it took place at my cabin at Loon Lake. The second interview took place after I had interviewed Angela Felt and Carl Salo here at Wayne State, and apparently Carl had talked to Elmer. Between the first interview and the second, something happened. I'm not sure what, whether Elmer had second thoughts, whether he had talked to other members of the camp who were opposed to my project, or what, but he seemed to me, my impression was that he was much more reluctant. However, despite his reluctance, he did come out to the beach and we talked for 2 hours about various things. And the third interview took place yesterday morning, August 18th, when he and Carl Salo together came to my camp. Elmer was very upset about the way a particular incident involving personalities had been interpreted, since he had been involved in the incident many years before. And in his anger, he wanted to withdraw all of the material. He has been good enough to give us a great deal of material, but he changed his mind after we reviewed what had happened and how the misunderstanding had taken place. I wish to make this transcript so that a copy can be sent to him and to me to be corrected, expanded, amended, deleted, but no other use is to be made of it whatsoever until Elmer's permission is given. Generally speaking, Elmer wished to emphasize three points very strongly. And so I wish to make these points at the outset on his behalf. The first is that with regard to anything in my project or anyone else's project, what he wishes to contribute about himself personally should pertain only or primarily to his experience as an immigrant from Finland coming to America, the series of difficulties that he went through and the incidents and the anecdotes connected with him as an immigrant Finnish American. He wished to stress that he did not want his politics brought into the story. It is not clear to me at this point whether his involvement in the history of the Finn camp is included in his in what he wishes to allow or not, and perhaps he can clarify this after reading the entire transcript. That's the first of the three points. The second point that Elmer emphasized again and again was that any involvement with the left wing, and in particular with communism at the Detroit Finnish camp, was the involvement through the Detroit Finnish Educational Association, as it is now called, and not the Finn Camp. Elmer is the one person whose memory goes way back to the beginning and who was involved very much in all of the committees that wrote the history and that helped to write the bylaws and change the bylaws and determine the activities at the camp, resolve issues of many kinds. Again and again over the years, he has emphasized that the Finn Camp was not supposed to be political in the first place, and it was not supposed to be political throughout its history. That any involvement or reputation of so-called Red Finns at the Finn Camp is associated with the history of the Detroit Finnish Educational Association. I might add on my own that the history of communist involvement in the DFEA may in itself be exaggerated in some directions. There were certainly members of the Communist Party in the DFEA, and not only is there a denial of it, there is a pride on the behalf of many people because of this. But the question of whether the communists were in charge of activities at the Finn Camp, Elmer feels, is a misrepresentation, that from the very beginning the effort was to separate the Finn Camp's activities as recreational activities from politics. The third issue that he emphasized and he wishes to have on record is his feeling that I must get the minutes of the Detroit Finnish Summer Camp from the beginning of its history to the present. This will mean translating the early minutes from Finnish. He feels that anyone who is a member of the Finn Camp is entitled to see these minutes, is legitimately so entitled as a member, if it's for a valid purpose. He cited his own experience in being allowed to see these minutes at the time that he wrote up what is now called Elmer's story in the 50th year anniversary booklet of the Finn Camp. I personally doubt that the present board of directors or the persons likely to be elected to the boards of directors will make it possible for me to see these minutes, but I will make every effort to see them. What I think I should emphasize is that Elmer's motivation is his desire to see that truth and accuracy prevail rather than rumor, that what actually was voted on and the statements actually that were actually made should not be dependent on the memories of people whose records are in oral history alone, that I should get the minutes, and I will certainly try. What follows now is my recollection based on notes for the first two interviews and memory alone for the third interview of the three interviews that I had with Elmer Mukkala during the summer of 1975. For the first interview, Elmer came over to my camp on his own, having heard about my project, very enthusiastic, eager to be helpful. He brought with him the Detroit Finnish workers' history, and of course I could not translate that, but he tried to help me to translate. His English is not everything he would like it to be, so he was eager to have me get help in getting an accurate translation. Then we talked rather casually, and he emphasized from the beginning, the very first point he made was that the Finn Camp was not supposed to be political. The question of the questionnaire that must be filled out by people who join the Finn Camp was raised in our discussion. It is interesting that my own memory, which goes back only 7 years, was here in error. I pointed out that when I had joined, I thought I remembered seeing the question, "Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" on the questionnaire. It turned out I was mistaken. That question was asked verbally when I joined, and my husband was with me at the time. The questionnaire, as I was shown later, I was shown my own questionnaire, and I did not answer any such question in my handwriting, so that it was a verbal question. But Elmer, during that first conversation, said that he had heard that a question had been added to the questionnaire unofficially, not stated in this way, but asking what organizations a person belonged to. I assume that he was suggesting that among the organizations, if they were members of the Communist Party or some other left-wing organization, this should have been mentioned. He said at the time that he had seen that question on the questionnaire again last week. So one of the issues to be determined is whether the questionnaire has changed or has not changed. There's a difference of opinion on this. Similarly, there's a difference of opinion on how the official constitution and bylaws have been changed over the years. Elmer then emphasized that any politics that was involved in the at the Finn camp was involved with the DFEA. The DFEA rented the campgrounds. It brought in speakers. It had plays and programs. It held many occasions there. And when the Finn camp needed money, the DFEA, which had been incorporated in 1907, bought the 5 extra shares to bail out the Finn camp from its financial crisis at the time. More on this issue later. Then Elmer pointed out that 3 years ago, the seniority rights for DFEA members who were 65 years old and over were raised, and they were raised in such a way that in order for the issue to be resolved, they had to have a general meeting. The Finn camp has a board of directors, and it can determine when an issue cannot be resolved by the board of directors and must be put before the semi-annual meetings. 4 times in a row, the issue was raised at the meeting, and eventually the large meeting voted not to give seniority rights to DFEA members. They did not give the reasons I have in my notes, as that Elmer said. Here one might conclude that the reasons might have had something to do with the politics of the DFEA members. When they lose seniority rights, that means that they are expected to work 24 hours a year the same way all others do. Other people who are 65 years or older do enjoy seniority rights. Elmer pointed out that he is treasurer of the DFEA, so he still has he certainly still has his associations with the DFEA. At the last meeting of the Finn camp, it was even suggested that the DFEA members, DFEA turn in its last share. Originally it had bailed out the Finn camp by buying the extra shares. Those extra shares had been turned in over the years, and the suggestion was made that all, even the last share, be turned in and some kind of statement made to honor them. I gathered from the way Elmer expressed honor them that he thought that was not exactly an honor, but an insult to the role that the members of the DFEA had played in the founding of the Finn camp itself. When I asked him about the meaning of this, he used the phrase, "It's an echo of 40 years." He says that since 1936, 9 years after the founding of the Finn camp, there had been a quarrel that had been going on. As he recalled it, there was, quote, "a bunch of 7 or 8 trying to get a foreclosure on the Finn camp," unquote. That is to say, he sees as the motivation involved in the 1930s, the group, this little clique, that wanted economic gain. And they were trying to, since the Finn camp was in trouble financially, they were trying to get the mortgage foreclosed. The DFEA in 1936 stepped in and bought enough shares so that they could get the payments, keep the payments, pay the payments on the mortgage, and keep the place. So the people who would have profited if the mortgage had been foreclosed became very angry about this. And Elmer thinks that some of the activities that those who are still alive have been involved in have as much to do with the fact that they're still angry 50 years later at not having won their side of the case as anything else. For example, they have insisted that the Green Book be printed at a non-union shop and other kinds of activities. So there's some kind of personality problem and personality clash in progress. Also, it is stated in the minutes, Elmer said, that the Finn camp is not political and that anyone of Finnish descent could join. The one issue, could they speak Finnish, has not been taken so seriously. Certainly at the time I joined, the fact that I couldn't speak much Finnish wasn't taken seriously. But at the time of McCarthyism, the reaction against any kind of leftism set in and began to be very great. I asked Elmer how that reaction began, if he could remember the year. His answer was that there had been a vote not to allow the DFEA to have its annual meetings and picnics on the grounds, so that when you read the minutes, it never says that the reason for the reaction is political, but he assumed that it was. And since that time, he couldn't remember the year, but we will have to look up in the minutes to find out when it was. Since that time, the DFEA could not have anything to do at the Finn camp at all. So they've moved all their meetings and activities elsewhere. At that point, I mentioned that the reputation the Finn camp had for being left-wing had caused hurt to the lives of a number of people who were blacklisted or blackballed or investigated by the FBI. That was the most common thing, to be investigated. And Elmer volunteered information on his own story. His own story is not unusual. A series of letters that he received while he was working at Bendix Aviation during wartime. And he even went home and got the letters and showed them to me. The FBI had been told some things about him. Later, Elmer was to find out that the information was given by one of this group of seven or eight who was angry with him and with the Finn camp for not having let them take over when they foreclosed. At least that was Elmer's theory. At any rate, there is a series of letters fairly similar to other kinds of letters that others received during the McCarthy period, asking him to answer a series of questions. Most of them have to do with his relationship to the Finn camp. And he got a lawyer to answer that letter, get the answers down correctly. Here's an example of Elmer's temperament that I think is very praiseworthy. He emphasized in our third interview that when he answered those questions, he told the truth. That when the questions were whether he was a member of the Communist Party or his wife was involved in some kind of activities, things that were patently false, he said they were false. But when the question was whether he was subscribing to a newspaper that was allegedly left-wing, his answer was yes, he had subscribed to it for 40 years, he intended to subscribe to it, to that newspaper for as long as he lived or it lived. Eventually, Elmer was to tell me that men from the FBI visited him personally and after his name was cleared and everything, and admitted that they knew the whole thing was, in his phrase, a lot of hooey, but they had to investigate because they had these letters. A later detail was added in the second interview to this particular private story of his. I do not think Elmer wants a private story included in any official statement, but he offered it to me as an illustration that he personally knew what it was like to face the danger of being blacklisted, of having your job taken away, of being smeared. And this is a man who has received the Distinguished Citizens Award from the city of Wixom, who is much admired and by many people at the camp, even though some of them say, as one said to me the other day, "I know he's communist from way back then. He's been communist for a long time. He is not a communist, but this is the kind of reputation that is spread when the truth is not put down." In any case, our conversation then went on to a discussion of the schoolhouse on the Finn Camp grounds. The schoolhouse, which is now a clubhouse and still stands, and I'll get a picture of the building into the records, was built jointly by the DFEA, apparently, and the Finn Camp. First, a few automobiles came to look the place over, and it didn't look very good. So they had a meeting at the Finnish Hall in Detroit, and made a series of rules so that they would not be affiliated with the DFEA. The Finn Camp would not be affiliated with the DFEA because the DFEA was because it was too big. I'm not clear whether the Finn Camp was too big or DFEA was too big. In any case, in 1925, on June 21st, the decision was first made, the emphasis was first made that it should not be political. Decisions were made on the number of hours people should work. The decision to make it a cooperative. The cooperative is a very important part of the history of the Finns in America. The decision on making the Finn Camp a cooperative is very much in line with that history. The decision was to have people work 10 hours, then 16 hours, then it was increased to 24 hours, which is what we work today. It is still a cooperative, and we do put in at least 24 hours, and something of the original spirit of working more hours if needed, this pride in working hard to get done what needs to be done, still exists. I testify to him, and I testify now that it still exists at the Finn Camp, though it isn't nearly as widespread as it was in the past. The agreement was made at the same meeting that the DFA could rent the area and the dance hall for weekends, as well as for its annual and semi-annual meetings. And this was as important, especially after the 14th Street Hall was sold. Then they rented another hall for the picnics. They paid $25 rent per weekend whenever they used the Finn Camp. And so that brought in regular income to the Finn Camp. One incident he related was a Juhannus, the big festival at the Finn Camp, Juhannus. Once when the Juhannus, which is the biggest event, Midsummer's Eve, St. John's Eve, is the biggest event held yearly at the Finn Camp. And during this one year, there were 6,000 tickets sold, 6,000. Which is an illustration of how powerful the DFEA was in bringing business to the Finn Camp that would allow it to survive. Okay, this led us to talking about how the idea of celebrating Juhannus and having the Koko, K-O-K-O, there came up in the first place. And Elmer says that one day a guy came to him. He thinks it was Nick Janhonen, J-A-N-H-O-N-E-N. That's possibly a misspelling. That a guy came to him with the idea that the Finn Camp ought to have, instead of having a picnic, ought to have the traditional Finnish Juhannus, complete with the koko. Now the koko is a large fire all year long. People collect wood and old chairs and broken things and pile it on a great big pile, and on Midsummer's Eve at midnight it is burned. And this is a Finnish custom, and the idea was that they should have a koko at the Finn Camp. And that year, when they announced that they were celebrating Johannes in Coco, instead of the usual picnic, they tripled the number of tickets that were sold. So Elmer's conclusion was that there was no objection when the Finn camp wanted to take over, when the DFEA was always ready and always made money available for the Finn camp. And so the Finn camp was quite willing to have them there. The DFEA was not the one to intrude on the Finn camp. The Finn camp was eager to have the DFEA there because they paid for their dances, they paid for drinks, they made $25 each weekend that they were there. And so they profited, and also from the beer. They profited from the sale of beer. There was no objection in those days about communist domination. On the list of accusations that was put on the personal letter he received from on Atomic Energy Commission stationery, it was listed that the phrases began with "It was reported that you are a member of the Finn camp, and the Finn camp is communist dominated." So he knew that somebody must have done the reporting, and investigating on his own, he learned that a particular man was going around in the sauna saying that the FBI was at Elmer's house and that was investigating him and so on. So it was a rather unhappy and tense part of his life, although the way he talks about it today, you would think that he managed it with great ease and that it never really bothered him much. That was the end of my first interview with Elmer. Then some weeks passed, during which, as I shall explain, the word got around that I was digging up this terrible history all over again and was going to open up the old wounds. And a number of people were upset and reacted, and I talked to a number of them, and I talked to the board. Following that, the two interviews were held down here. And Elmer was called. Meanwhile, he had also had his arm broken. It was in a cast, and he had to have the cast removed. So it was physical pain for him as well. But anyway, eventually, on August, about 16th or 17th, on a sauna day, he came down to the sauna, and we sat at a picnic table at the sauna and talked for about 2 hours. And he indicated to me that he would, if it would be okay, he surely would give his personal history, but he didn't want to talk about anything involving politics. So he had apparently changed his mind, or felt that I might in some way misrepresent something. And he did begin to tell his own personal history, the outlines of which are as follows. He was born in 1885 in Lahti, Finland, L-A-H-T-I. And there's a story connected with how he came here. It was a little hard to get details, and perhaps he can write them down more clearly when he reads this transcript. But the year in 1908, he came to America given an address of a place to come. But when he got here, discovered that there was no such place. There was no such address. The place was a place near Port Arthur in Canada. And he had come, I'm not sure whether it was with a friend or with his brother, and they were staying, they had no place to go, so they were sleeping overnight in a depot waiting for daylight, and a couple of men saw them. They turned out to be Finns, and they asked them in Finnish where they were going, and they told them, and they said, there's no such place. So he and his cousin, that's who it was, he and his cousin went to Port Arthur, directly to Port Arthur, having no address to go to and no place to go, and 20 cents in their pocket. You're supposed to have $25 money, but they had used the same $25, so they were down on their money by the time they had bought their tickets. And they got a job in Port Arthur, and he worked there for a while. Later, he worked in Winnipeg. And from there, he went to North Dakota, then back to either Port Arthur or Winnipeg, and then back to North Dakota again. Later, he went to Edmonton. He was interested in a hunting expedition, but that didn't turn out. He slept outside during this period. There were wolves roaming around. He knew what it was to live without food. All they had was salt, but there were plenty of rabbits around, and they would catch rabbits and cook them, and lived on rabbit meat for a week during this stay at Edmonton. In 1914, he remembers he was in Seattle. There was a depression, and the lumber camps were open, especially for the so-called high flyers. Next, he mentioned that he was in Idaho working in the mines. The mines had jobs, and he worked there for 2 years. And then he was in Butte, Montana, where he had a close call with death at one point. There was an illness, a plague, a black pneumonia going around that a number of the workers were getting. And a number of them were brought to Mayo Clinic, and they were kept at Mayo Clinic for 8 months. Elmer suspects that they were guinea pigs being used. After 8 months, they were still not well. So what exactly was done to them, we don't know, but here's a story that ought to be investigated. I was surprised that he had lived in so many places and worked in so many places that did not have, so far as I knew, large numbers of Finns, but he said I was wrong, that in Butte, Montana, I remember as one example, there were a lot of Finns and that he did meet them from time to time. Then eventually in 1917, he came to Detroit because his brother was here. And here I'm going to stop.